Chapter 5. As Juan Cabrillo jogged to the boat garage located just aft of the superstructure, he listened to damage reports on his comm unit. The bilges were dry, which wasn't a surprise. The riverbed was silty mud, nothing that could breach the hull. What he was worried about were the keel doors. At the bottom of the Oregon were two large doors that opened outward, creating a moon pool. From here, the pair of submersibles the ship carried could be launched directly into the sea. Used mostly for covert insertions and extractions, one of the mini-subs had a diving capability of 1,000 feet and a manipulator arm, while the smaller mini-sub, a Discovery 1000, was limited to shallower water. To his immense relief, a tech on duty at the moon pool reported the two doors hadn't been damaged and the subs were safely stowed in their cradles. Juan reached the boat garage at the ship's waterline. The large space was lit by red battle lamps, giving it a ruddy cast, and it smelled of salt water and gasoline. The large door that opened along the Oregon's flank was tightly sealed as crewmen prepared a black Zodiac inflatable. The big outboard on its transom could push the craft well past 40 knots, though it also had a small electric motor for silent operations. The garage also housed a deep-hulled seal assault boat capable of even greater speed and with the capacity to carry 10 armed men. Eddie and Link reported in a moment later. It had been Eddie Seng who'd played the part of helmsman when Link was acting as captain. The two couldn't have been more physically different. Link's body bulged with muscles hewn from hours of pumping iron in the ship's weight room, while Eddie was rapier lean, his physique the result of a lifetime of martial arts training. They wore black combat fatigues, matching belts festooned with ammo pouches, knives, and various other gear. Each carried M4A1 assault carbines, the Special Forces version of the M16.
"What's the op, boss?" Eddie asked.
"As you know, we're grounded and we don't have time to wait for the spring rains. You remember that dam we passed a couple miles back?"
"You want us to blow it?" Link asked incredulously.
"No, no. Just get inside and open the floodgates. I doubt they have guards, but if they do, go non-lethal if you can."
Both men nodded.
"You probably won't be able to catch up with us once the water hits us, so we'll link up in Boma on the coast."
"Sounds like a plan," Link breezed, fully confident in their ability to execute the mission.
Juan hit a wall mic. "Eric, I need to know when it's clear to open the garage and launch a Zodiac. Where are those patrol boats?"
"One's standing off. I think to start in with the mortars again. The other just passed behind our stern and is coming up the port side."
"Anything from the shore?"
"Infrared shows it's clean, but you and I both know Abala won't waste any time getting here."
"Okay, thanks."
Juan nodded to a crewman to open the outer door. The stench and heat of the jungle rushed into the garage as the door slid upward. The air was so humid you could almost drink it. It was also tinged with the chemical stink of the smokescreen Max had laid over the ship. The river's edge was dark and overhung with dense vegetation. Despite Eric's assurance that the shore was clear, Juan could feel eyes on them. Because the Oregon rode so high in the water, the launch ramp was 5 feet above the river. Link and Eddie shoved the boat down the slick ramp and dove after it when it hit the water. They emerged from the river and rolled over the craft's soft side. Eddie secured their weapons while Link engaged the electric motor. At slow speed and under the cover of darkness, the Zodiac was all but invisible. As they pulled away from the Oregon, Link had to zigzag around arcing jets of water from the fire cannons that were keeping the two helicopters from getting close. The choppers dove and buzzed, but never got nearer than 100 feet before one of the cannons fired a blasting stream of water that forced the pilots to bank away sharply. Eddie could imagine the scene inside each of the helos as the rebels threatened the oil company pilots, while at the same time knowing a direct hit from one of the fire hoses would drown the helicopter's turbines and send it plummeting into the river. They emerged from the smoke screen and saw that the two patrol boats were far enough away for Link to switch to the Zodiac's outboard. The big four-stroke was well muffled, but it still sounded a deep bass tone that rumbled across the water as he brought the nimble craft onto plane. It was impossible to speak at 40 knots, so they drove back upriver with their thoughts, both men keyed up on adrenaline and ready for anything. They didn't hear the high keening of an approaching boat until it shot around a small island hugging the near shore. Link whipped the Zodiac hard to starboard as the two boats nearly collided. He recognized the scared face of Colonel Abala's aide at the same instant the rebel officer recognized him. Link twisted the throttle harder against its stop as the aide-de-camp whipped the boat around and started to chase them. The boat was sleek, with two outboards and a low hull designed to ride atop the water. There were four other men with him, all carrying AKs.
"You know him?" Eddie shouted.
"Yeah, he's Abala's right-hand man." The rebel boat began to gain on the Zodiac, a rooster tail of water jetting from its stern.
"Link, if he's got a radio, the jig's going to be up."
"Damn, I hadn't thought about that. Any ideas?"
"Let him catch up," Eddie said, and passed one of the M4s to Lincoln.
"And don't fire until I see the whites of their eyes?"
"Screw that.
Take them the second they're in range."
"Okay, hold on." Link killed the throttles, and as the Zodiac settled into the water, he whipped it into a tight turn, its flat bottom skipping across the river like a stone. It came to a sudden stop, bobbing on waves of its own creation, but it was more than stable enough for Link and Eddie. They brought their weapons to their shoulders as the rebels' boat bore down on them at 50 miles per hour. At 200 yards, they opened fire. AKs immediately winked back at them, but the rebels' aim was off because the boat was going so fast. Tiny fountains of water shot into the air well ahead and to the left of the stationary Zodiac. The corporation men had no such difficulty, and every second brought the boat closer and increased their accuracy. Link fired three round bursts that stitched the small windscreen and tore chunks of fiberglass from the boat's bow. Eddie concentrated on the driver, calmly firing single shots until the man suddenly slumped. The boat veered for a moment before another rebel got hold of the wheel, while the other three continued to rip through magazine after magazine. One burst came close enough to singe the air around Eddie and Link, but neither man ducked or even blinked. They methodically fired at the oncoming boat until only one rebel remained crouched behind the wheel, covered by the long bow. Working in coordination, Eddie kept up a steady stream of fire as Link moved back to the idling engine. The rebel boat was no more than 50 yards away, charging straight at them like a shark coming in for the kill. It was obvious that its driver intended to ram them. Link let him come. When the speedboat was no more than 20 feet away, he goosed the throttle and the Zodiac dashed under its high bows. Eddie already had a grenade in his hand, the pin pulled and the spoon long gone. He flipped it into the speedboat's cockpit as it screamed by them, holding up five fingers, then dropping them as the seconds ticked by. His last finger went down and the speedboat went up. The crump of the grenade followed almost immediately by the spectacular explosion of the boat's fuel tanks. The hull cartwheeled across the water, chunks of fiberglass and the remains of its crew flying free amid the blazing rain of burning gasoline.
"Strike one right-hand man," Link said with satisfaction.
5 minutes later, the Zodiac coasted to a wooden jetty near the base of the Inga Dam. The massive structure loomed over them, a sculpted wall of ferro-concrete and steel holding back a huge reservoir above the Congo River. Because nearly all the electricity generated by the hydro dam was used during the day in the mines of Shaba, formerly Katanga Province, there was just a trickle of water coming down the spillway. They dragged the boat well out of the river and secured it to a tree, not knowing how high the water would reach. They hefted their weapons for the long climb up a set of stairs built into the face of the dam. Halfway up the stairs, the quiet of the night was shattered by gunfire erupting from below them. Shrapnel, bits of concrete, and bullets whizzed all around them as they stood exposed on the steps. Both men dropped flat and immediately returned fire. Down below, two native boats had pulled up to the jetty. While rebels fired from the dock, more began racing up the stairs. "I guess Abala's guy had a radio after all," Eddie said, dropping his spent M4 and drawing his Glock. He fired rapidly as Link hosed the dock with 5.56mm rounds from his assault rifle. The three rebels charging the stairs went down with double taps from Eddie's pistol, their bodies tumbling off the steps in a tangle of limbs and blood. By the time he'd changed out magazines for his M4, the fire from the dock had withered to a single AK-47, and Link silenced this gun with a sustained burst that blew the rebel off the dock. The current took him almost immediately, and he vanished down the river. Above them, an alarm horn had begun to sound. "Let's go," Link said, and the two men raced up the stairs, taking them two and three at a time. They reached the top of the dam. Beyond it was the large reservoir, and at the far end of the structure was a squat building with light spilling from its windows. "Control room," Link whispered. "Has to be." Eddie pulled his throat mic into position. "Chairman, it's Eddie. Link and I are on the dam and about to approach the control center." There was no need to tell him their presence had already been detected. "Copy that. Advise when you're in position to open the gates." "Roger." Keeping low so they didn't silhouette themselves against the starry sky, they raced silently across the top of the dam. To their left spread the reservoir, a calm lake bisected by a white slash of reflected moonlight. To their right was a 100-foot drop to a jumble of boulders littering the base of the dam. When they reached the blockhouse, a boxy, one-story concrete building with a single door and a pair of windows, they could see that beyond it were the sluice gates and penstock that diverted water to the facility's turbines that were housed in a long building at the bottom of the dam. There was only enough water passing through the channel to provide electricity to the town of Mabati. With Link on the other side, Eddie reached out and tried to open the blockhouse door. It was securely locked. Eddie motioned to the keyhole as if he had the key and cocked an eyebrow at Link. Franklin Lincoln was the corporation's expert at lockpicking and was rumored to have even broken into Juan's gun safe on a bet from Linda Ross. But all he could do was shrug at his partner and pat his pockets. He'd forgotten to bring his picks. Eddie rolled his eyes and reached into one of the pouches hanging from his belt. He molded a small amount of Semtex plastic explosive around the handle and inserted an electronic detonator. He and Link moved a short way off. Just before he keyed the detonator, a guard emerged from around the blockhouse. He wore a dark uniform and carried a flashlight and a pistol. Link aimed instinctively and was an instant from firing before adjusting his sight picture. He shot the pistol out of the guard's hand. The man went down, screaming and clutching his arm to his chest. Link ran over to him, pulling a pair of flex cuffs from his combat harness. He checked the wound quickly, relieved that it was superficial, and bound the guard's hands and feet. "Sorry, buddy," he said, and rejoined Eddie. Eddie fired off the charge. The explosion blew the handle apart, and Link threw open the door, Eddie covering him with his M4. The control room was brightly lit, an open space with banks of dials and levers along the walls and counters mounted with outdated computers. The three night operators immediately thrust their hands in the air when Link and Eddie rushed into the room, shouting for everyone to get down. They gestured with their rifles and the men sank to the concrete floor, their eyes wide with fear.
"Do as we say and no one gets hurt," Eddie said, knowing how trite it sounded to the terrified workers.
Link did a quick recon of the building, finding an empty conference room behind the control space and a closet-sized lavatory that was also empty, except for a cockroach the size of his middle finger.
"Do any of you speak English?" Eddie asked as he cuffed the three Africans.
"I do," one said. The tag on his blue jumpsuit showing his name was Kofi Bako.
"Okay, Kofi. Like I said, we're not going to hurt you, but I want you to tell me how to open the emergency floodgates."
"You will drain the reservoir."
Eddie pointed at a multi-line telephone. Four of its five lights were blinking.
"You've already contacted your superiors, and I'm sure they're sending additional people.
The gates won't be open for more than an hour. Now show me how to open them." Kofi Bako hesitated for another second, so Eddie yanked his pistol from its holster, making sure it was never pointed at the three men. His voice went from reasonable to savage.
"You've got 5 seconds.
"That panel there."
Bako nodded at the far wall.
"The top 5 switches disengaged the safety protocols. The next 5 closed the circuits to the gate motors, and the bottom 5 opened the gates themselves."
"Can the gates be closed manually?"
"Yes. There is a room inside the dam with big hand cranks. They need 2 men to turn them."
With Link still at the front door watching for any more guards, Eddie flipped the switches in turn, watching the jeweled lights that were built into the control panel switch from red to green with each toggle thrown. Before he started on the last row, he rested his throat mic against his neck.
"Chairman, it's me. Be ready for it. I'm opening the gates now." "Not a minute too soon. Abala transferred the mortars from the swift boats and has set them up on shore. A couple more rounds and they have us ranged."
"Stand by for the big flush," Eddie said, and threw the last set of switches. With the last toggle in position, a noise began to rise, low at first, but building to a rumble that shook the building. The gates were coming up and water was thundering down the face of the dam in a solid wall. It hit the bottom and exploded in a roiling cauldron that grew into a solid wave 8 feet high that swept down the river, inundating the shoreline and ripping out trees and shrubs as it accelerated.
"That ought to do the trick," Eddie said, and emptied his clip into the control panel.
The rounds punctured the thin metal and shredded the old electronics in a blaze of smoke and sparks.
"And that ought to buy us some time," Link added.
They left the technicians cuffed to a table and made their way back down the staircase. The sound and fury of the water pouring over the dam's face was a palpable sensation, while spray soaked their partially dry clothing. By the time they reached the bottom and dragged the Zodiac to the river's edge, the water had settled enough for them to launch the inflatable and start heading downstream for their rendezvous in Boma. Back aboard the Oregon, Juan was getting concerned. Abala had realized the swift boats were too unstable for the mortars, so he'd unloaded them and now his men were dialing in the range. The last explosive had hit less than 20 feet from the starboard rail. To add to his problems, more and more native boats were arriving from upstream, loaded to the gunwales with rebels. While the water cannons were performing flawlessly, there were only 4 of them, and 2 were needed at all times to prevent the buzzing helicopters from getting close enough for the men aboard to jump down onto the freighter. Juan had called Holly Kasim back from the radar dome to coordinate communications so Linda Ross could lead Eddie's shore operations fighters. Using only shotguns and pistols, they rushed to the side of the ship where Mark Murphy said a boat was getting too close. They fired down on the rebels while ducking blistering fire from both the shore and the pirogues.
"All right," Holly exclaimed from the comm station. "My techs have the radar back."
"Will you be able to see the wave?" Juan asked him.
"Sorry, Chairman, but with the bends in the river, I won't see it until it's almost on top of us."
"Anything's better than nothing." Another mortar dropped near the ship, this time missing the port rail by inches. The rebels had them bracketed. The next rounds would fall with impunity all over the Oregon, and her decks were not nearly as heavily armored as her flanks.
"Damage control teams, get ready," Juan said over the shipboard net. "We're going to take some hits."
"Holy God!"
Holly shouted.
"What?" "Brace yourselves!"
Juan hit the collision alarm as he saw the wave on both the radar screen in the corner of the big monitor as well as the feed from the stern cameras. The surge stretched from bank to bank, rearing up more than 10 feet and easily traveling at 20 knots. The roiling wall of water bore down on them relentlessly. One of the swift boats tried to twist away and race ahead of the swell, but was caught midway through its turn. The wave hit the vessel broadside. The patrol craft flipped instantly, tossing men into the maelstrom where they were crushed by the rolling hull of their boat. Pirogues simply vanished with nothing to mark their passing, and the rebels lining the shore taking pot shots at the Oregon fled for high ground as water washed away everything in its path. Juan took his hands away from the controls a moment before the wave slammed into the Oregon, flexed his fingers like a pianist about to perform an impossible overture, and lightly rested them back on the keys and joystick that would maneuver his ship. He brought the unclogged drive tube up to 20%, just as the swell lifted the stern of the Oregon out of the mud. Like being caught in a tsunami, the vessel lurched from a dead stop to 20 knots in an instant as a pair of mortar shells exploded in her wake, shots that would have blown through her rear cargo hatches and destroyed the Robinson R-44 helicopter stored on a retractable elevator. Juan scanned engine readouts, pump temperatures, speed over the bottom, speed through the water, and his position and course, his gaze darting from one screen to the next in an unending cycle. The ship was actually making only 3 knots through the water, but was racing down the river at closer to 25, borne onward by the tremendous pressure of water escaping over the Inga Dam.
"Max! Tell me the instant that second tube clears," he called out. "I don't have enough steerage speed."
He edged the throttle higher, fighting the current as it tried to slam the Oregon into an island that had reared up in the middle of the channel. His fingers danced over his keyboard. He called up the bow and stern thrusters as needed to keep the ship straight and more or less centered as the dark jungle blurred past. They careened around a tight bend in the river, the flow pushing them hard for the opposite shore, where a small cargo ship that had been headed upriver had been pushed into the riverbank, its stern thrust far out into the Congo. Juan slammed on full power to the thrusters, laterally shoving the Oregon as far to starboard as he could. The hull scraped against the coastal freighter with an ear-splitting shriek, and then they were clear.
"That's going to leave a mark," Eric quipped, even though he was awed by Juan's handling of the vessel.
He knew he wouldn't have made the turn and avoided the ship. With the river boiling all around them, they were swept further downstream, carried along like a leaf in a gutter, barely able to control their course until Juan could eke more power out of her engines. Time and again, he had to fight the river to keep the Oregon from grounding or plowing into the riverbank, each escape seemingly closer than the last. They did hit a shoal at one point, the ship decelerating hard as it gouged a furrow through the muddy riverbed. For a moment, Juan feared the freighter would grind to a halt again because the computer had shut off the pulse jet. But the current was strong enough to drag them over, and as soon as the bottom was free, the ship picked up speed like a sprinter out of the blocks. Despite the danger, or maybe because of it, Cabrillo found he was enjoying the challenge. It was a test of his skills and the capabilities of his ship against the vagaries of the raging flood, the epic struggle of man versus nature. He was the type of man who never backed away from anything because he knew his limitations and had yet to meet a situation he didn't think he could handle. In others, this trait would come off as cockiness. In Juan Cabrillo, it was simply supreme confidence.
"Scouring action has cleared the second tube," Max announced. "Just be gentle on her until I get a team into it to check for damage." Juan dialed up the second tube and immediately felt his ship respond. She was no longer sluggish coming about, and he had to use the thrusters less and less. He checked their speed, 28 knots over the bottom and 8 through the water. He had more than enough speed to control the freighter, and now that they'd covered several miles, the once turbulent flow had started to even out. Colonel Abala's forces were either dead on the river or left far behind, and the two choppers he'd stolen had peeled off soon after the wave hit.
"Eric, I think you can take her from here on down to Boma."
"Aye, Chairman," Stone replied. "I have the helm." Juan sat back in his chair. Max Hanley placed a hand on his shoulder. "Hell of a piece of driving, if I say so myself."
"Thanks. Don't think I want to do that again anytime soon."
"I'd love to say we're out of the woods, but we aren't. Battery charge is down to 30%. Even with the current at our backs, we're going to run out of juice a good 10 miles from the sea."
"Do you have any faith in me at all?" Juan asked, pained. "Weren't you here when Eric said mean high tide is in?"
Juan checked his watch.
"An hour and a half? Ocean's going to run 15 or 20 miles inland and turn the Congo brackish. Might be like running regular gasoline in a race car engine, but there's enough salinity to spool up the magnetohydrodynamics."
Max cursed.
"Why didn't I think about that?" "For the same reason I get paid more than you. I'm smarter, more clever by half, and much better looking."
"And you wear your humility like a well-tailored suit." Max then turned serious. "Soon as we get to Boma, I'll get some of my engineers into the tubes. But from what I could tell from the computer, I think they're okay. May not be at 100%, but my gut tells me they don't need to be relined." Though he carried the title of president within the corporation and was tasked with a lot of the day-to-day affairs of running a successful company, Max most enjoyed his role as the Oregon's chief engineer, and her state-of-the-art engines were his pride and joy.
"Thank God."
Replacing the lining of the drive tubes was a multi-million-dollar job.
"But I don't want to be in Boma any longer than necessary. Once we pick up Link and Eddie, I want us in international waters just in case Minister Isaka can't keep the heat off us for opening their dam," Juan said.
"Good thinking. We can check the tubes in the open ocean about as easily as tied to a dock."
"Anything else from the damage reports you've gotten?"
"Other than a broken X-ray machine down in medical and Maurice squawking about a whole lot of broken dishes and glassware, we came through okay." Maurice was the Oregon's chief steward, the only member of the crew older than Max. Better suited to the Victorian age, Maurice was also the only non-American aboard. He'd served in the British Navy, overseeing the mess on a number of flagships before being cashiered out because of his age. In his year with the corporation, he'd quickly become a crew favorite, throwing the perfect parties for everyone's birthdays and knowing which delicacies they preferred from the ship's highly trained cooking staff.
"Tell him to go easy on what he orders this time. When we lost all those dishes racing to save Eddie a few months back, Maurice replaced them with Royal Doulton to the tune of $600 a place setting. Max arched an eyebrow, quibbling over a few pennies. We lost $45,000 worth of finger bowls and sorbet cups. Okay, a couple of dimes then. You forget that I've seen our latest balance sheets. We can afford it. Which was true. The corporation had never been in better financial shape. Juan's gamble at forming his own private security and surveillance outfit had surpassed even his most optimistic estimates, but that also meant there was a downside. The need for such organizations in the post-Cold War world was a sobering fact of life in the 21st century. He'd known that without the polarizing effects of two dominant superpowers, regional flare-ups and terrorism would proliferate all over the globe. Being in a position to make a profit from conflicts, provided they had a say in which side they chose to help, was both a blessing and a curse that racked Cabrillo in the sleepless hours of the night. "Blame my grandmother," Juan said. "She could stretch a dollar for a mile and have change left over. I used to hate going to her house because she always bought stale bread to save a couple of cents. She'd toast it, but you could tell. And toasted bologna sandwiches are about as disgusting as you can get." "Okay. To honor your grandmother, I'll tell Maurice to stick with Limoges this time," Max said, and sauntered back to his station. Hali Kasim approached Juan carrying a flat-screen clipboard. A frown turned down the corners of his mouth and made his gunslinger mustache droop.
"Chairman, the Sniffer caught this a couple minutes ago."
The Sniffer was their name for the dedicated surveillance array that swept the electronic spectrum for miles around the ship. It was able to siphon in everything from regular radio broadcasts to encrypted cell phones. The ship's supercomputer sifted through the minutiae every half second, trying to detect a grain of intelligence wheat in all that chaff.
"Computer just broke the code. I'd call it high-end civilian or mid-level military encryption."
"What's the source?" Juan asked, taking the glowing clipboard from his communications expert.
"Satellite phone broadcasting from 40,000 feet.
That means either a military aircraft or an executive plane," Juan said. "Commercial jetliners rarely fly above 38,000.
"That's what I think, too. Sorry, we caught just the beginning of the conversation. Sniffer went down the same time as the radar, and by the time it was back up, the plane was out of range."
Juan read the single line aloud. "Not quite so soon. We'll have Merrick at the Devil's Oasis by 4 a.m. He read it again silently and looked at Holly, his face a mask.
"Doesn't mean much to me. I don't know what the Devil's Oasis is. But when you were on the dock unloading the weapons, Sky News broke the story that Jeffrey Merrick was kidnapped along with an associate from his company's headquarters in Geneva. Working backward, given the information provided by the wire services, a fast executive jet would put Merrick and his kidnappers right over our heads at the time we intercepted this call."
"I assume we're talking about the same Jeffrey Merrick who runs Merrick Singer?" Cabrillo asked.
"The billionaire whose inventions in the field of clean coal have opened up a world of possibilities for the industry and made him one of the most hated men on the planet by environmental groups because they still think coal's too dirty.
Any ransom demands yet?"
"Nothing on the news."
Juan made his decision quickly.
"Get Murph and Linda Ross working on this."
With her background in naval intelligence, Ross was the perfect choice to spearhead the research, and Murph was the best at finding obscure patterns in an avalanche of information.
"Tell them I want to know exactly what's going on. Who took Merrick? Who's in charge of the investigation?
What and where is the Devil's Oasis? The Works. Plus, background on Merrick Singer. What's our interest in him?
Altruism, Cabrillo said with a piratical smirk.
Nothing to do with the fact he's a billionaire, huh?
I'm shocked you'd think that of me, Juan said with convincing indignation.
His wealth never left my mind. I mean, entered it.